Closed captions are available for this video and full transcripts can be found on our blog.
Hello, my name is Debbie Reynolds. I'm a data privacy strategist and expert from Chicago, Illinois, and a member of the Node Zero community at the Data Collaboration Alliance. So, welcome to the Data Drop panel, where every month we discuss some of the leading data privacy and data news around the world and talk about things that we think the audience will care about. So we're stripped from the headlines, but going a bit deeper on these things. So, in this type of world where we have this fast-paced, eyebrow-raising news around data and privacy, it really makes sense to do these types of panels. And I'm really happy to have this special guest here. So all the stories that we feature today also will be included in our sister Data Drop News podcast, which delivers a 4-minute data privacy news roundup every week. So without further ado, I want to introduce our guests today for the Data Drop panel. We have Jeff Jokic, who's a data researcher and principal at Privacy Plan. He's a data privacy consultancy and data set provider from Florida. Welcome, Jeff. We have Samir Ahero. He's the founder and CEO of Ardent Privacy in Washington, D.C. And David Kruger, who's the VP of strategy, co-founder, co-inventor of Apsio Corporation, creator of software-defined distributed key cryptography from Texas. Hello.
Hi.
Well, before we get started, Jeff Jokic, my buddy, has a community announcement he'd like to make.
Thanks, Debbie. Just wanted to make sure the community of privacy pros out there knows that we have a new privacy gateway, which is a tool for privacy pros to be able to access a lot of new data sets that the Data Collaboration Alliance has available. So it's in beta now. If you want to come check it out, there will be a link at the bottom of this episode. So check it out. It's got a lot of great data sets that are available right at your fingertips. So please check it out and give us some feedback.
Thank you, Jeff. I really appreciate that update. I highly recommend people jump in over on these data sets. They're tremendously helpful, and it's really the best free resource I've ever seen, and I've seen a lot, right? So let's start with our first person and news item. So David, let's start with your story. Google, Meta, pushback against changes to Australian privacy law.
Yeah, I just thought this was interesting, especially in light of the fact of Facebook's stock plummet and the sort of when I read this article, it's almost a little bit of a panicky undertone here. With this line, I'm quoting from the article: Australian consumers benefit from being able to access free digital services funded by personal advertising. And what I continue to see here is this tight coupling of free to targeted advertising, right? You get this free service, and this is how we pay for it. Shut up and love it, kind of an attitude there. But I think one of the things that's interesting in our space is this: there is a continued move to decouple the advertising model, in a specific way. So back in 2002, when Google discovered that they were collecting this personal information, they were primarily using it for user experience improvement, and then they found out they could repurpose that data and begin to target ads for it. But now you have this host of startups and using privacy enhancing technology that allow you to do that advertising without collecting that personal information, right? And the technology has advanced so much that now setting up a separate facility just to crawl the web and catalog data and to be able to produce search results is a tiny, tiny fraction of what it used to cost, right? So it's just interesting to think about what happens to Google and what happens to this whole model when you can the cost of delivering the search results, which used to be very expensive, is incredibly cheap, and you don't have to collect users' data to be able to deliver targeted advertising. So, you know, it shows up as this continued assumption that this model is going to remain unchanged, and I just don't think it is. And again, they're going to push back against the collecting of personal information in the exchange. Well, this is free. Well, if you don't have to have their personal information and delivering search results is cheap, how does that change things in the long term? That's an interesting question to me.
I see a lot of a lot of wisdom there in what you're talking about, David. There are so many different ways that I think you can provide advertising that you don't necessarily have to go down the path of the pure surveillance capitalism that we're currently using right now. I actually heard a really interesting proposal from, and I forget the guy's name, but it was a gentleman from the EFF in a podcast a couple months back, where he was proposing a model that he labeled forgetful advertising. And the concept was to essentially use most of the data points that Google already collects, but once the ad is actually served, to then essentially forget all of that information and move along. And that's an interesting proposition. So if you could actually, you know, have the data, present the ad, and then forget all of it, so that now that you can move along, where would that lead us? Could that be a model that could actually work?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, you don't need to collect data to with modern technology to deliver the advertising. You also don't need to collect data on people to deliver search results. You do need data to distort search results, to tailor them in such a way that you can increase your ad revenue, but you don't need them in order just to deliver the results. You never have. So this further uncoupling of the free service from the need to acquire all this private information. It's just going to continue.
One comment there, right? So we got to be a little careful about for the early stage companies or the companies who are coming in existence, because if you understand big tech, Google, Facebook, Apple, whoever, they already got 20 years or 15 years worth of data. So they may not need more personal data and research, right? So even if we stop collection of data today, right? I'm not saying we should be collecting more data, but they have a more advantage compared
to... I kind of disagree with you in one way, Samir, because the value of the data that they hold is the value of their company. It's not in their intellectual property. It's not in their hardware. It's not in their people. It's in the value of the company. Google, for example, 85% of its revenues come from advertising. But the way that advertising system works, it has to be constantly refreshed with new data, because they look at that old data compared to new data, do continuous individualized trend analysis to know what ads to deliver. Well, that's entirely dependent on having a constant influx of new data. So the value of their data that they hold, right, plummets. I mean, it just goes, I mean, its value drops very, very fast if it can't be continuously updated. So again, the value that they hold is predicated entirely on the value that they continue to bring in, because the two must work together to deliver targeted advertising the way that they do it.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree. I'm just, what I was saying was that the early or other smaller companies should not be disadvantaged, because it might be in the favor of, again, that to have that regulation so nobody else has data and only they have. That's the only point I want to make. I'm completely...
Yes, yeah, I got you.
Very cool. So let's go to the next topic. Jeff, Ontario pledges to become the first province to protect workers from digital spying by bosses.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about workplace surveillance. This is a big topic because with the move to remote workplace because of COVID, our bosses are spying on us a whole lot more, at least for most jobs. And that's really sort of changed workplace surveillance a whole lot. It didn't used to necessarily happen for every job, maybe some jobs, certainly lower level jobs, bosses have been spying on us for a long time. But it's really sort of moved that sort of issue to the forefront of a lot of privacy pros' minds. And, you know, a lot of people sort of think that they have a lot of privacy rights, but those rights change a lot in the employment situation. A lot of those rights sort of go out the window when you sign an employment contract, at least in the United States. It's a little bit different in Europe. This law sort of essentially is not saying that you necessarily get all those rights back, but Ontario is essentially saying that your bosses are going to have to tell you if they're spying on you, which is a really interesting way to sort of go about this. It's not saying they can't spy, but they have to tell you if they're going to spy. So I think it's a really good move. I think it's a valuable move. And I'm very much in favor of this.
What do you think, Samir?
Oh, I mean, absolutely right. It's both sides of the story, but in terms of people are worried, right? More and more remote workplace coming up. But I think there has to be a strictly balance there, what you can do, what you cannot do. But it also brings a kind of challenges, right? What people do from the employee side. So employers also need kind of information, right? People are not just checking out and things of that nature. So I think it's a strictly balanced thing between the employee and employer, their contact. But of course, surveillance, continuous or basically extra or additional surveillance is absolutely not good. So we got to be ultra careful there. But at the same time, we need to understand from both perspective that the productivity should not be impacted as well, right? As an employer also, right? So we need to take just both sides of the coin.
What do you think, David?
Well, you know, apart from the Ontario's ruling, which I think is smart, it's a dumb idea to spy on your employees. A few years ago, 8 or 10 years ago, there was this proliferation of companies that that allowed you to contract through them to, you know, offshore developers primarily, right? You could go find your developers and assemble your staff. And a lot of the companies offered what was then a new technology that basically allowed you to spy on your offshore developers. You could, you know, watch them type, they have a webcam, you could see that they were in front of it. They gave you meter reports that told you, you know, how long people were spending each hour, you know, entering code or working on code and that type of thing. And that got a lot of uptake very quick. And then it went away very quickly because they found out that people resent being spied on. They're uncomfortable with it. Productivity went down. And sort of the lesson learned from that was that spying on your employees is a poor, poor substitute for hiring trustworthy people.
Yeah. And it's also a poor substitute for managing. Yeah. So it's like, be a better manager.
No, I mean, this is the thing, why do you think that this will work is a question I want to ask these guys. What is it that your people get from your how you perceive them? And why do you think it's a good thing that you're declaring up front that they're not trustworthy? You think that's going to be helpful?
Great point. Well, Samir, your turn. So in the U.S., we recently had President Joe Biden do a State of the Union address. And then also you wanted to talk about the DHS's privacy chief who aims to promote privacy-enhancing technologies.
So I think first good news, right? There is some traction in the U.S. federal space for privacy, right? So State of Union is always sought after in the larger community. So I think the whole mention of privacy as a term, starting from children, that was definitely outstanding that some get it. But interesting statistics actually they put together. They said that one estimate, advertising firms, right? And we just talked on the David's point earlier, they hold 72 million data points on an average child by the time they reach age of 13. I have 14 and 12-year-old, and I can understand, right? With YouTubes of the world and whole ed tech, what they have to use for that, that's dangerous, right? So the advertisers collect data even before they know, right, what internet is all about and how to responsibly use them. So I think it's a very good news that there is a attention there. I think there are several states as well as are taking a good action, including here in Maryland, where I live, Educational Privacy Right Act. And I think especially with the minors, it's absolutely good news. Other thing about the DHS privacy, so she actually talked about putting in technical design, so fundamental aspect, just like we do security by design, that she will talk or she will basically promote the privacy enhancing in the technical designs, a product which is are being procured at DHS or overall the agencies which come under that umbrella with DHS. So that is also good news. So I think overall what is happening is at federal or even at the commercial, I think the whole incidents, more and more incidents gonna happen about the privacy, and we're gonna know bad impacts of it as a society, and that's gonna drive these regulations. And just like Apple did, right? That $300 billion loss with all the advertising social media companies. So I think it's just a driver force, natural, not just regulatory, but natural bad stuff happening will actually improve the whole privacy value prop for all this big tech and consumer focused companies automatically. And that's a good news. The attention by the government, especially in the State of Union, is a fantastic news.
I also want to just throw in for anyone who doesn't know what DHS is, it's the Department of Homeland Security in the U.S. So I'm an anti-acronym person.
Thank you, Debbie. Yeah.
So I actually read through all the stuff that Biden talked about in the State of the Union address. And I also noticed that statistic, Samir, that you talked about, where they said by the age of 13, companies have up to 72 million data points on kids. One thing I will say, I know the U.S. gets a bad rap about data privacy regulation. We have some of the strongest children regulations, right? So under the age of 13, obviously we know that companies don't abide by that in the way that they should be. So in a way, I'm glad that we're strengthening those privacy protections for children. But, you know, as you know, once you get to, 13, 15, 16, 18, you know, your privacy protections drop precipitously from there. Really interesting story. So let's go to the next topic. Let's see, what do we have? So David, Google to change privacy policy on Android under UK's competition oversight.
Yeah, it's just again, it's just interesting to me because of some of the language in there. So it said 90% of the apps available on Google Play Store or app are free, also thanks to digital advertising. So this is really a continuation of that last story. However, the announcement added that the app ecosystem remains healthy and that the industry must continue to evolve how digital advertising works to improve user privacy. And it talks about the new setting will limit the share of personal data with third parties. That's the key there, third parties in work without cross-party identifier. So the interesting thing about this story to me is the way that they cast what is actually going on. And that's, you know, Google's advertising system is a walled garden, right? You have to work with Google in order to be able to access the benefits of it. You got to pay them a cut, you know, every time somebody clicks on an ad, right? So what's interesting to me is that they talk about this in terms of privacy. But nowhere in any of the announcements that Google's made, you know, they've abandoned Flock now. They're trying to develop this new privacy respecting ID. Nowhere does it say that they're going to slow down on the collection of data for their own use, right? So I'm always intrigued how you can get away with saying that this is about user privacy when it's doesn't have anything to do with user privacy. It has everything to do with further restricting people, forcing them to use Google's walled garden advertising ecosystem. So I'm always a little bit of intrigued how you can cast that as privacy when your data collection isn't slowing down at all. Color me cynical.
I'll jump in on this one. So basically, there are proposals around the world around third-party data sharing. And so what these regulators are trying to do is stop that sort of exchange. But what happens, and the thing that Google will benefit from, so they can sort of stop these third parties or whatever, but they are a first-party data holder. So most people use Google, you know, it's the most widely used search engine. A lot of people use it on their phone. A lot of people take their phone everywhere that they go. A lot of people have, you know, these, you know, not just the phone, but like other devices that collects this information. And all this makes Google a first party to that data. So really, they don't have to stop. You know, they have this relationship. So they're all the way home, I would say. What are your thoughts, Jeff?
Well, you know, I think that this the privacy sandbox is a hell of a lot better solution than Flock was. So Google has definitely improved on what they were proposing before. But David's right that they're not really doing much to regulate themselves in terms of privacy and what they're doing with data privacy practices. Will it actually help consumer privacy? Yeah, I think it's going to take more personal information off the market. There will be less data brokers out there with profiles on us, though they may still have profiles that have poor quality data that just isn't getting updated. So maybe that actually hurts us in some ways. But there'll be less data flowing to those brokers, right? And other advertising platforms. So that's good in that sense. But aggregating it all to a couple of players like Apple and Google, that's got its own set of problems.
I agree. So Jeff, you say Bloomberg loses appeal in landmark UK privacy case. This should be interesting.
Yeah, this is where, you know, different rights sort of butt against each other. So we have a reasonable expectation of privacy. That's sort of a baseline for privacy, at least in the United States. And that sort of started back in a court decision called Katz v. U.S. Back in 1967. And that was really where reasonable expectation of privacy test came about. And it essentially said that Fourth Amendment searches occur when a government violates a subjective expectation of privacy that society recognizes as reasonable, and said that the Fourth Amendment protects people and not places. And what this decision is really saying, and this is a European decision, right? It's from the UK, and Britain's Supreme Court dismissed an appeal that Bloomberg made, saying that a person who was under criminal investigation has a reasonable expectation of privacy until they're charged. And so essentially this was a guy who wasn't famous and he got charged with a crime, and Bloomberg reported on it and essentially said, you know, hey, this guy's being investigated. But it turned out that he wasn't, right? And so he sort of became famous for something he didn't do. And so the question is, should reporters report on people that aren't famous, right? Just because they're under suspicion of something. And the court said, no, you can't do that. So the problem is this abuts against, you know, the rights of the press to be able to report things, you know, in the public interest. And those also have, you know, certain rights. You know, in the United States, there's a real important case called Cox v. Cohen, where, you know, it gets quoted a lot, right? Where the press has rights, First Amendment rights, to be able to release names. In that particular case, it was the rights to release names of rape victims, which is pretty egregious, right? But it essentially sort of established the rights of the press to be able to release, you know, names of non-famous people. And so how do we sort of, you know, compare the right of privacy to the right of the press to be able to release information? And that's what this decision sort of, you know, gets to. And it's a tough thing to compare.
Oh, what do you think, Samir?
Yeah, so it gets into more of a loyalty. So I'll take Jeff's on that. But again, I think balance is the key here, right? we have our own right to privacy, and at the same time, what can you do? So I think I'll pass on that, talking too much about it, because I'm on the engineering side of it. So
you want to jump in, David?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think Samir is right. You have to, it's a balanced thing, and you have to depend on being reasonable. Along with Katz, you've got Sullivan, right, which basically gives media sort of a free-for-all. We can say whatever we want, no matter what damage it causes. You can't come after us because we're the media.
Right.
There's limits that have to be applied, but unfortunately, they you can't make a law that's a one-size-fits-all. People need to be reasonable. And reveal that which is reasonable to reveal, and hold close that which is unreasonable to be revealed. And then therein lies the rub. Laws aren't going to solve this situation. They may make it some improvements, but you're still going to have to rely on people doing the right thing. And that's unfortunately always an iffy proposition.
Yeah, this looks like Bloomberg was trying to set a precedent here, and it was not a good one that they set, right? But I think most people should know, or hopefully Bloomberg should have known, that in the UK, they're more strict around stuff like this, reporting around crimes and stuff. You know, I've seen major cases where they use, you know, anonyms, right? Some anonymous, you know, suspect 123 or whatever, just because they know that this information gets proliferated in the media, and especially if it's a bad information or it's not accurate, they don't want that to, you know, just sort of continue with the person. So I think this should be a heads up for any organization that's reporting stuff, at least around sort of criminal things, and especially also the UK has a rule, like say for instance someone did a crime, they went to jail, they, you know, got out of jail, their conviction is considered spent. So at that point, you can't really hold it against them. So that's something that people who are doing advertising and doing marketing and doing these stories need to understand. It's just it's very different than it is in the US in terms of what they think is kind of the protection of the individual in the press. All right, Samir, you want to talk about IRIS regulator could halt Facebook, Instagram, and EU-US data flows in May.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, right? I think there is a lot of news around EU and US, how EU regulator is actually going after. And of course, I think Max Rem and all those decisions were kind of set kind of precedent with that. So interesting. So as soon as May, I mean, that's very serious. There was also news where Google Analytics, they give something that you can't use that in EU. So I think we're gonna hear more about that, more and more, in terms of how we use all these technologies. And if you see, there was another news where another regulator, I don't know if it was French or German regulator, they said that, thank you, Facebook, if you can't provide our services in, I think Facebook said that we might have to just log out or don't offer services in that region if laws don't get like loosened up for them. And they said, thank you, we don't want those companies here. And so it's gonna be becoming more interesting, more pro-citizens. And of course, EU respects privacy as a fundamental right. That's just an example of in legal language, how they're interpreting this. One interesting thing that it's about Facebook and Instagram, WhatsApp is still excluded from that. So your phone numbers and data collection goes there, but they say WhatsApp has a different data regulator as a registered entity. So they are going after, I think, the scoping Facebook and Instagram one step at a time, as that's what the regulator said. So I think that the whole regulatory portion between those data transfers between EU, US, or even EU and rest of the world, they're gonna go upward. The concerns there, and I think more people gonna have to change their strategies. And if you are changing that strategy for such a large market, I think that sets precedent for entire world that, hey, you should not be doing deceptive data practices when you use it. And it's a societal issue now. So I think we're gonna see more of that.
What do you think, Jeff?
Well, you know, there's a lot of high stakes high stakes games of chicken going on. You know, you've heard that Facebook's talked about sort of pulling out of the EU, and I think that, you know, probably the data transfers. Well, I don't really see either of these things actually happening. I think probably there's going to be some sort of agreement that's reached. What I think probably is going to happen is that Facebook's going to figure out a solution that allows them to keep European data in Europe, and all of this probably goes away. They're probably avoiding that solution for whatever reason. It's probably not very easy to accomplish, and maybe not even very. It's probably not very efficient monetarily for them to do. But that's probably what ends up happening in my mind.
We saw last year that the EU US privacy shield was invalidated. And we've been waiting. We thought that something would happen already with kind of, you know, renegotiation there, but that just has not happened. So I think a lot of these companies are caught in the middle in terms of that. And so it's just going to be a tough way forward. And I think Jeff is probably right. They'll come up to some agreement. A really big sticking point in Europe has been like the Cloud Act, the U.S. surveillance, and, you know, the reach of the U.S. federal government to U.S. companies who have operations in foreign countries. So I think until that gets straightened out, we're going to see a lot more cases like this where they're like, you know, get out of our country. We can't do X, Y, and Z. So it's a tough issue for sure. So I want to thank all of our special guests today, Jeff Jokic at Privacy Plan, Samir Ahero at Ardent Privacy, and David Kruger at Absio Corporation. So for anyone who's interested in finding out more about the Data Collaboration Alliance and the No Zero community, go over to datacollaboration.org/community. Thank you.
The Data Drop is a production of the Data Collaboration Alliance, a nonprofit dedicated to advancing meaningful data ownership and global collaborative intelligence. Data Drop viewers are invited to check out Node Zero, our free community where members collaborate on datasets, dashboards, and open tools in support of important causes. Visit datacollaboration.org.